Hello, my name is Terry and I'm an alcoholic.
I'm Terry.
Grateful to be sober today. Grateful to be at an AA meeting. Even though they've got a big pulpit. This reminds me of church. I never know how to start sharing. I just never know. A few standard things I say. One of them is that I'm not so surprised that I'm sober. Because I'm very surprised that I'm grateful to be sober. I'm not so surprised because the first thinking I did about drinking after I started was, this is too good to be true, something's going to happen. They never let you keep doing something that feels as good. They're going to discover a law will be passed, some tragedy is going to happen, I know. And I was right. I think that if you have that feeling, it means you value a high the way I value a high. I get a big kick out of a high. It speaks to me. I had a fairly good education and upbringing before I'd had my first drink. I was in a position to put the experience of having a high into perspective. I had ample chance to do that. I'd like to tell you the chance I had. The dinner with Phyllis tonight, and she was cross-examining me about my younger years. I had this extraordinary education in respect to our disease for those days. Those days being the 40s, I grew up in a family where we called all of our alcoholics, alcoholics. But they didn't call alcoholics in your family alcoholics in the 40s. They were either unmentionable or they were drunks. We were very advanced. The reason we did that is my father had his father bring the Post article over the week it was printed in 41. Made a special trip over, part of the family lore is, and handed him the Jack Alexander article about Alcoholics Anonymous. Said, why don't you find out where these people are? Because my father was a periodic, a madman alcoholic. And he found out where they were, and he was in the program for a time. So I grew up with easy does it one day at a time. It's a disease. Alcoholism is. First drink gets you drunk. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. I had all that straight by the time I was around 5 or 6. It went on from there. But that was an advantage. And my father died of this disease. I had a few slips, and he died in withdrawal when I was 6 years of age. A couple of uncles were around. One of them got in the program, went to meetings with him. So I grew up with another uncle in the program, going to meetings with him once in a while. And all that stuff. So I was kind of raised as some of your kids are being raised in the program, and awareness of it. And then I went to the seminary and started to be a priest. I live and work as a Catholic priest in the middle of Los Angeles right now, and I like it. And I started out at an indecently young age to go to school to head in that direction. And just before that, I even took the trouble of taking a pledge not to drink till I was 21. And I kept the pledge. Everybody said that Catholic kids did that in the 40s and 50s when Irish bishops cornered you at confirmation. And of course, this thing out of you. Everybody stand up who wishes to take the pledge. And sisters in the back looking for everybody to sit down. And everybody assured me, they said, nobody keeps the pledge. Relax. Have a drink, And I wouldn't relax. I think it's part of my disease that I kept it, obsessive compulsive thing. So by the time I started, and the last thing about that era was just to say that I I wrote a paper on alcoholism in college, the longest paper I ever wrote. I read the big book and a half dozen other books on alcoholism 2 years before I had a drink. So when it came time to drink, I was in this position, being a seminarian who was in a school that allowed no drinking, a head full of facts floating around about alcoholism, no money to speak of, no friends who caroused around much, with massive social encouragement to not drink a lot. And those practically ideal circumstances, I had my first drink. And it impressed me the kind of way seeing the Grand Canyon the first time or hearing Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, you know. It's the kind of thing where you want to nudge somebody in the room and say, man, isn't this great? And I liked it a lot. It warmed up my tummy, kind of radiated out. The tightness in my chest loosened up. My IQ went up about 25 points. And I became deeply convinced that anything I'd say would be interesting. And that's a lot right there. And that was instant. It never was different. I just couldn't get over it. I thought, you mean to tell me there are liquor stores open all over the country every day? You know, why does anybody go to work? And right while I'm saying that to myself, I'm realizing that I'm planning on going to work tomorrow, and I'm not, they're just going to chase the bottle down the street. I'm going to have to be careful. I immediately empathized more deeply with my father and uncles. I kind of understood something I couldn't understand before. And I liked it. I think if that's the way... I was an alcoholic, obviously, who had alcohol poured in. Obsessed and... I don't know. They say, you know, utilize, don't analyze, but you get to analyze a little bit if you it's an hour after all. one analytical thought is that for a person like me, an alcoholic of my type, I've just got a chemistry. I'm put together in such a way with my endocrine system and whatever else it takes. When alcohol is poured into me, I feel like a spiritual experience is coming on. Now, one isn't coming on, and it's, in fact, the chances of a spiritual awakening are greatly diminished when I have a drink. In fact, they're made impossible. But it touches that part of me. You know, it feels like something wonderful is going to happen. That it just, hope arises, the pressure goes down, and there's a promise of some release and something wonderful. And I'm a sucker for it. It's really neat. After I had enough experience to know that nothing particularly good happened when you have a drink, I still felt it might. I still felt it would, but I knew it wouldn't. And I can remember thinking through, after I had been fired and hospitalized and repeatedly detoxed and treated for alcoholism and aversion treatments, still, when an obsession came on, I can remember my head going through this little number, if you drink, you'll die. It's all over. You're a joke. I mean, you're a disaster when you drink. Just straight down the tubes. I thought, well, I feel like I'm dying right now. I think I'd rather have a drink while I'm dying. But will not have a drink while I'm dying. And that's the way alcohol affects me. Right off the bat, I was a booze fighter. And a booze fighter is a pathetic creature. Booze fighter is somebody who's trying to do two things at once. I was trying to get as much to drink as I possibly could, and I was trying to make sure I did not get drunk. And if you keep both of those things in mind throughout the evening, It'll keep you very busy. You got to do a lot of arithmetic and recalculations. And I did a lot of arithmetic when I drank. I would measure the bottles and the ounces and the percentage of alcohol and the minutes in between drinks and the hours between now and when I had to get up in the morning and the amount of money I had and the size of the room. I don't know. I took a lot of things into consideration. And all this scurrying around in my head was so that I could get as close as I could to the feeling I want and not get into trouble and keep functioning and be good anyway. A lot of work. And when I felt kind of fortunate when I could forget one or the other of those two things. Either not, and I would do the not, you know, get as much to drink as I possibly could. I remember early on in my drinking, I would turn down a drink when I knew it was the only one. Because one drink, all that did for me was ruin 3 good hours in the day. So I always wanted a drink. When I had a drink, I really wanted a drink. It took a number of hours to get by that when I was trapped and couldn't. And I'd skip it, so I would skip one half of it and feel all right. I went along as a student, drinking when I could. I didn't have many opportunities, but I always did it with obsession. I always did it with, I was willing to lie, cheat, and steal out of the starting gate. It just seemed to me that it wasn't lying and stealing. I think it's part of the whole deal. Like, you gotta lie if you drink, like I drink. You better lie, or they'll cart you off before the day is over, you know. If they knew what was going on inside of us, what our real plans were, you wouldn't get much cooperation out of society, I'll tell you that. But it just seemed to me that it was something fitting about the way I would steal. And I came from a family with, where very explicit and high ideals were instilled. I was the type of kid who didn't even steal candy from the drugstore in the seventh grade. I didn't even do that. But when I began to drink, I didn't break stride before I would steal in order to drink. I guess I wouldn't steal just anything, but I would steal what it seemed possible. And my idea was this, that if I needed a drink so bad that any person with a sense of decency would give me the drink. And since you would give it to me anyway, I was going to just save you the trouble of having a long explanation about why this was important. And I actually felt it was a favor to people at times that I saved them that long explanation of why I needed the drink. And in lying, that's just part of the territory. It didn't seem to me I was lying when I would drink. It was more like having a right of privacy. You don't have to blab everything, tell your whole life every time you turn around, you know. It seemed to me fitting that I maintain a certain discretion. But what I was doing was living a life where I took care to never, ever mention the main thing on my mind, the drinking plan for today. And everything that went along with it. And if you're a drinker, you can't tell anybody about that stuff, and you got to tell some of the lies to make sure you don't tell them. For example, you know, why do you choose this restaurant to have lunch in when it's 10 miles out of the way for everybody? Well, because they got a bar, you know. It's very important they not know that. Real important. I fantasized what it would have been like had I ever told the truth. That's the kind of guy I like in it. How come you didn't? How come no one else laughed? Anyway, I did this little scenario. I never did tell the truth, but if I had ever told the truth in a social drinking situation, I imagine it would have been something like this. Or if you had invited me over to your house It's a Friday night, kind of a night to have a little gathering with booze. And if I knew there'd be booze there and you asked me over, I'd say, yes, I'll be there, if there wasn't something better. And if I were going to tell the truth that night, which I never did, but if I would have, I would have probably done it like this. Come over to your house, knock on the door, you'd answer the door. I'd say, hi, thanks for asking me over. I'd like to lay my cards on the table and get a few things straight before we start out this evening. I'm here to drink. I'd like a double scotch right now. Not later, after we talk, now. And I get my double scotch and look, you were nice enough to ask me over. I'm going to be a good guest. You got games to play? I'll play the games. You got other people coming over? I'll mix it up. I'll do as well as I can. Just don't get between me and the bar. And we're going to do all right. Sometimes I get a little bit gassed on this kind of an evening. But usually I do all right. I get through pretty good, but once in a while I go nuts. And I might get in a fight or throw up on the rug or pull up the douche your wife or your mother. But that's the chance you take when you ask me over. Anyway, that's doesn't sound like many people told the truth here. That's the way it was. It's the way it is, not what. Is. You know, me and alcohol. Anyway, I went along in my booze fighting way with more self-conscious, and in about 2 years, I gave it up. I lasted 6 months. Resumed drinking after 6 months on the wagon by myself with the thought that anyone who could quit drinking for 6 months have proved he could quit. And as long as I was sure I could quit, I might as well start. Because if there's any trouble in the future, I'll just quit fast. Nip it in the bud, you know. So I started again. And I then remembered why I quit, you know, to begin with. But it was so much work. I made heavy, so much work out of drinking. It was always just plotting and thinking it over and trying to solve it. And so I quit a lot after that. And I was a real quitter, starting and stopping. And I did that so much that I really wouldn't know on any given day whether I was in a quitting period or not. People ask me, would you like a drink? Just let me figure this out. I sure hope I'm not quit lately. It was like that for months of that stuff. And while I was going through that time, I considered myself a non-drinker. I was a non-drinker who drank sometimes. And it was important for me to have that identity of a non-drinker because I knew. I knew down deep that this was sick, that you are one of those. But then I finally quit quitting because I thought, you know, because if you quit drinking more than 10 times a month for life, it will affect your self-esteem. So I thought, you know, self-esteem is a big thing in mental health, and I thought this would probably enhance my self-esteem if I quit quitting and didn't have this failure syndrome going and just maintained with some, accepted myself as a drinking man and try to smooth out. And I did that and smoothed out in about a fifth of scotch a day as the young skinny priest in Los Angeles who was trying to show up at things as best I could. And I was getting drunk about once a week, and I did not get to pick the time or the day. There are some alcoholics who get drunk in a regular pattern. It isn't that they have power over their drinking, it's just that that's their MO. Some people die of the disease getting drunk on a very predictable pattern. I wasn't that kind. I was the kind that would get drunk Tuesday morning, Sunday night, and never knew. Never knew. And it was all, I never get drunk at this time. Here it is. I was thinking of myself as an alcoholic by this time. I was thinking that I should stop. I just thought, well, when am I going to stop? I considered the possibility of being an alcoholic before I even drank with all that reading I did. And I thought, if I do become alcoholic, which I knew was possible, in fact, it was about, I thought the odds were about even, because so much of my family, and I had one older brother, he was showing lots of signs of being normal, which I thought statistically was not good for me. I thought if I became one, that I would notice it because of my good education. And once I noticed it, I would stop. And so I thought, well, I better stop. And then, you know, I didn't. And it went on and on, and this grinding daily drinking. I didn't have to go a long time with that compared to many of my brothers and sisters. When I was ordained a priest less than 3 years, I was fired after a few talks with the boss. And I lost my job. I lost my assignment. I didn't become a non-priest, but they didn't pay me anymore. If you get fired, that's a big deal, but if you live where you work and drive a company car, it's a major deal. And so I got to go to my first hospital trip. Now, that was kind of a dividing line. I thought, well, they got me, fair and square. I couldn't complain. They say, are you an alcoholic? Yeah, of course I'm an alcoholic. I had no trouble admitting that on the surface. And even a little bit, it went down a bit. The first drink gets you drunk. You bet the first. Let me tell you some stories. I could go. I did about a first drink thing. It was easy, you know. Absolutely. And they insisted on going through these aversion treatments where you get warm salt water and a nausea drug and you drink something and then throw up. You get drowning panic nausea. It's a special brand that alcoholics are familiar with. Anyway, I went through five of those sessions, or happened in 10 days, and with a spirit of good sportsmanship and some kind of a little bit of alertness, you're supposed to stay sober for the rest of your life from the strength of that. And I went through. I'm a wonderful patient in a hospital. I'm accustomed to highly structured living situations. I know how to make alcoholic counselors feel fulfilled. I did very well. They had high hopes, you know. I was the young, smart one, graduating with honors. And I lasted 3.5 months. I was in a new place and was drinking. I had a revelation obsession. I had two kinds of obsession. The revelation obsession is very simple. You just get a message. It's just, in 20 minutes you're going to have a drink. It will all be damned. I thought I'd last longer, you know, after hospital and everything, you know. The beach is going to last longer. Well, it's 20 minutes. Off I go. And I was often drinking light wine and lasted 4 or 5 days before I was back in the hospital. And had lasted almost a year after that, and then drank out of a sense of absolute heroic achievement, having been almost a year. I like the way I handle character defects in without a program. My self-pity is kind of a safe one to talk about. Not sex or anything. I thought self-pity was the kind of defect that has no class. It's a pain in the neck to the person who has it, to everyone around and gets it inflicted. I decided that I did not want to have self-pity. That's not a defect I wanted. So I did my best not to have it. And if you don't have a program, the way you not have something is pretend you don't have it as best you can. And so I went along my attitude about drinking, about sobriety, about being dry, so it makes sense, you know. I'm an alcoholic. I'm diagnosed. There's no question about it. I'm allergic to alcohol. If I drink, I just go down the tubes. It's very destructive. And I won't drink, and I'm going to be grown up about this. I'm not going to be a crybaby and go moaning and groaning. This is reality. I'm going to take life as it is, good and the bad, be grown up about this. I'll never be able to relax again for the rest of my life. You're not going to catch me crying about that, you know. It's just, that's the breaks, you know. Some people get to be happy, some people don't. And I lost. That's the way you handle it without a program. Anyway, I began drinking after I think it was a wear down obsession the next time. That's the revelation type I told you. The wear down goes like this. You feel like having a drink and you tell yourself, listen, dummy, we've been through this drink thing. You've been hospitalized. You don't get any anymore. Remember? I wouldn't drink. I'd feel like having a drink a couple of weeks later. I'd say, look, you're no good at it anymore. You don't even have any fun when you drink. You're a loser the minute you start. Don't drink. So I wouldn't drink. And I'd feel like having a drink again in a few more weeks. And I'd give myself the long pitch. I'd explain everything I could remember. Everything the counselor said, everything I can remember that I read, and it could get all done with a good lecture, and I'd feel like having a drink. What do you do, say to myself, anybody who would still want to drink after all I've explained to you, and after all you've been through, anybody who would still want to drink after all that is so weird that you're not worth working on. And you might as well have a drink. And have a drink. So having a drink out of humiliation that you want to drink. And the program of Alcoholics Anonymous addresses that issue very early. And it's wonderful, isn't it? I mean, I would drink out of humiliation. I thought I was supposed to get over not just any desire, but I thought I was supposed to get over the, you know, the grab you from behind, pull you down, obsession, laughing at you, you know. Ha-ha, you're not going to drink anymore? You're going to drink. You save yourself a lot of trouble by having it tonight instead of 3 days of misery. So I drank, and I got to be at that hospital again a number of times, and I... went back 5 times. The fifth time, after 23 aversion treatments, which I think puts them in jeopardy of all kinds of lawsuits. I don't know what it was. They got nervous about me and asked me never ever to call them up again. I know I was at least a morale problem. And lasted a little bit. I was in the wagon again, and then drinking into a psycho unit to detox. And it was there, on my sixth detox, that something new happened. And the new gift, I think, from my higher power was that I discovered in myself an awareness that I was going to be drunk again pretty soon. You thought I was going to say something nice, didn't you? Yeah. That was the message, that you're the type that gets drunk again. There are some alcoholics who are nice alcoholics. When you hold them down and explain the facts of life to them, they finally get it, you know. It's a disease, the first drink gets you drunk, ask God's help, and then they catch on and they stay sober, you know, and they kind of get with it and have a life. Then there are the heartbreakers, you know. You say the same thing, explain everything, and they nod the same way as the other ones do, and they kind of cooperate in a way, and then they just disappear. You just turn your head one day and think they're gone, and you hear, well, someone's drinking. What do you mean drinking again? They caught on. I knew. They understand. And I was one of those, like my father, like my uncles. You know? And with that conviction that I would be drinking again pretty soon, I got to go to a 12-step house. And because I was so young and smart, I only had to stay 5 months. I wintered in Jersey. I'm a Southern Californian, beginning, and I There is a certain part of your drinking where you can get a ticket from Jersey. Easy. Just ask anybody, they'll give you one. If they want to get rid of it bad enough, you know, that state. Anyway, I got back there, and that's where my higher power touched me. That's where it started. And it went almost my first meeting. Somehow I was jarred loose, and something in me was made willing to listen. And I started listening, and I had no idea the good things sort of happened right away. I kind of liked going to meetings. I didn't know why. Certainly wasn't my type of thing. You know, folding chairs and church basements, no visual aids, amateur hour. Not my type of thing. But it was real and better than TV. And it was, my heart was beating. I was identifying, you know. And I didn't have identification in my active vocabulary. I kind of knew what it meant vaguely, but I didn't talk about it because I wasn't doing much of it. And you were just drawing me in, and I was being healed. Isn't it, you know, we get to be healed, we get loved and helped, and things start coming together long before we can figure anything out about it, I think. I know that my higher power started healing me and doing good things to me. The minute he beat me down enough where I couldn't resist as much as usual, it just started. And I picture the beginning of my program as kind of a loving arm going around my shoulder and someone whispering in my ear and telling me all these things, that saying, you know, we understand. You're the bad type of alcoholic. We understand you. We understand that, right? You're the type that doesn't catch on, that loses interest in recovery at odd moments. After your fifth hospitalization, when you're sure you'll die, you just kind of get, your eye gets off the ball, and you kind of forget about that recovery stuff and have a drink. Then we understand that's the type you are, and that there's no use talking to you because you've got this extra crazy thing in you that loses interest in survival, where other people seem to have a good sportsman-like attitude, and you're a sneaky little bastard who has something insincere down there that just doesn't care. Or cares intermittently, and that's all it takes, you know. If your steering mechanism works intermittently, it'd almost be better if it didn't work at all. Instead of saying, you have to get over that, my program, you were saying to me, my higher power is saying to me through you, was, we understand, yeah. Everybody kept saying, yeah, we're good. Oh, yeah, you're that bad. Oh, good. Have a seat. You need this place. You don't want to come anymore. We expect that about this time of your recovery. Have a seat anyway. You don't care about being of service to anybody in the world, and you'd like to be, but you have to admit you just don't care about anyone. Well, you're just the type for the program, because everybody, in fact, has to be of service to somebody, and unless you're in the program, no one will bother you enough to actually get you to do it, and you'll have to die. But if you just stay here while you're not interested in being of service, you'll be tricked into being of service, and you will find out that it's so healing and you like it so much that you will regain an interest in living, and you will be happy for months before you know that you even feel good. And all of this happens in a way you can't possibly understand, and that we can't explain. So we just shut up and listen to the rest of the meeting. And that kind of stuff was being said, and it was all different than I expected. I expected kind of a luxury thing, shape up, and it was all, come on, loosen up a little. You're worse than you realize. We know you're worse than you think, and you're going to live better than you dreamed. You're going to regain a capacity to live like a regular human being. And I didn't think that. I kind of knew my secret was, there's something in me that gets bored stiff with everything wholesome, you know, bores me after about 20 minutes. And half acknowledge that. You say, oh yeah, that's the type that really needs the program. Yeah, that's good. You're here. Oh, well, it means that everything I'd ever say or acknowledge within myself wasn't thought, but was affirmed by the program. And I just feel that's what's going on now, you know, keeps going on. As I got to where I liked meetings, and I was one of the ones who wanted to go in this 12-step house, and I got out and came back to Los Angeles and got an assignment downtown, and I looked around for meetings, found a lot of them. I had the great good fortune to be assigned to a place right on Skid Row West, just west of the Harbor Freeway. I counted, it was a parish that was a 1.5 square miles and had 28 AA meetings on the parish boundaries. With having the Royal Palms Hotel in that. So, really had more than half of them, right there. And but it was neat. And I started, and I got in. And it was the fundamental change in my life. I like to say that I try to find out the change that recovery involves. I doubt sometimes whether my recovery is the good kind. You know, I don't feel like I'm taking the step as well as I should. But there's a big difference between recovery and not recovery. I'm even hesitant about saying this, putting any feeling to it, because while we're recovering, we can feel awful. You know, we can feel just awful, awful, awful in me. I think the sure sign of recovery is not a feeling. It's the fundamental not having a drink and a fundamental connection to do footwork, to do something. To not have a drink and to hold on. To not have a drink and show up. Not have a drink and take a step, do a footwork thing. But usually there's a feeling change, I think, that goes along with recovery that's pretty widespread. And the feeling that I think most is before recovery, I don't care whether I live or die. And I have yet to meet a drunk or a dope fiend who was unable to identify with "I don't care whether I live or die." It seems to go with the experience of alcohol and drug abuse. And in recovery, there's times when it could feel that way. You might put it that way. But for the most part, I'm interested in how things are going to turn out. So I could feel negative and terrible, but I know I'm in on things. I'm in on life, and I'm here. Sometimes I drift. And I can find dishonesty creeping in, and it's my fault and so forth. But it's not like I don't care whether I live or die. I can be touched now, and I'm being touched. And I can say things from my heart enough to see the look in someone's eye back. And I feel like when we start recovering, we reopen for business as human beings. You know? No prize examples. But we're in business again. And that's what I figure happens when I'm dying. I go out of business as a human being. I'm kind of dying on my feet. I tend to understate that, you know. I'm not saying in glorious terms. And I guess that's where my head works. I want to make sure this isn't phony, right? I want to make sure that I don't want to exaggerate. I don't want to say, dun, 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 dun. Just come to meetings and you will be happy, joyous, free. You know, what we get is way beyond anything. I just feel, as I day at a time didn't drink and started to show up, there was this deep change of resisting everything that was wrong with me to having AA put his arm around my shoulder and say, "Would you loosen up a little bit? We know you are a dingbat alky of the worst kind, who is a secret, undisciplined, sensualist egomaniac." with no interest in your fellows at all. We know the type you are. We're not horrified or ashamed of that because we're that way too. And we'd like you just to relax a little bit. Whatever you do, don't have a drink or take a pill. And we'd like you to follow these directions. And then, I implicitly ask, and then will I turn out all right after that? No, you won't. You'll be pretty much the same person. You'll have pretty much the same deep inclinations and the same insatiable need for attention and being admired and being reassured 10,000 times. It won't really do it for you. You'll be pretty much that way. But you'll be sober, and if you follow these directions, you will find out that you are living like a human being, and you're making connections, and you will be touched in your heart, and you will know that you are loved, and you know that you can give love, and you will be amazed that as you begin truly living, that you stay an alcoholic and you stay emotionally immature in many ways. You got the urge to do things wrong constantly. And the capacity to do them right enough to be true to people, and you will know that there's just a deep, unshakable hope for being able to receive love and be and do it and do your life while you remain looking pretty silly for the most part, and you won't have you've been. I know I always wanted to achieve peace, to achieve the satisfaction of, to achieve what the big book calls emotional security, spiritual and emotional security, by having my perfectionistic tendencies satisfied, you know, by getting them, by getting perfect. And I kind of laughs about that. No, you got it all wrong. What you do is you become willing, with God's help, to be the jumble of imperfections and abilities, to be a child of God who has your dignity and your capacity to love and be loved with all kinds of weird things about you, and to be willing to be that and to be willing to show up and play ball with 12 steps. And you say, but, no, just play ball. I know I'm very much alive with the neurotic attitude. So the program has to wipe this out at all. I always have I want to get over things. I want to get over being a procrastinator. I want to get over being lustful. I want to get over being wanting praise. You know, what a childish, unworthy thing. While the world's full of problems and children are starving, I want to be admired. You know, that's disgusting. I'd like to get. Can I get over anything? And my program says to me, no, you can't get over anything. You'll get over something once in a while once you don't care about it. Once you don't notice it at all anymore. But you don't get to get over anything. We'd like you to do your footwork, to be honest with your sponsor, to show up, to give everything in the program, and be always willing to feel like a fool. And that seems to be the way it works. And then when you do screw up good, well, the program has ways of dealing with that. The program doesn't say, oh, you screwed up, well, get over it and be perfect. No, it says, work the first step, be willing to be the type of person who screws up in that way in which you did it. If there's amends to be made. Let's discuss that. And then have no guarantee that you won't do it again. There may be more humiliation in store soon for you, you know. And that's, you know, the program, to me the program is everything in our fellowship of the program draws me away from the habit of my lifetime. And that is being a narcissistic little, a very self-centered person who's worried about how I do. And the program doesn't give at all care how I do. The program cares about how we do. And taking care of the kids and being decent to other people. And doesn't care about my status one whit. It's not important. The program really has first things first. And I can't wait around until my head gets in the right place where I have first things first the way the program does. I don't think I'll... I can't wait for that. I'm too sick to wait around to have a spontaneously healthy attitude. I'm going to not have a drink and do the steps while I have a lousy attitude. Then we can live. Thank you very much.